Ever heard that saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts? Absolutely. Kind of gives you chills, right? Well, today we're going to be looking at that idea through the story of one of history's most famous leaders, King David. Yeah,
Okay.
the giant slayer, the guy who wrote the Psalms, the hero from the Bible. But what happens when that hero kind of messes up? What happens when the good guy makes choices that, I don't know, kind of shatter our image of him?
That's exactly what we're diving into today, and we're going to be using an academic lecture series on the Book of Samuel as our guide. And believe me, this is way more than just a Sunday school lesson. We're going deep into the psychology of power, the complexities of human nature, and maybe even uncover some uncomfortable truths about ourselves along the way.
Okay, so before we get to all the drama, let's back up a bit. Who is David at the beginning of the story? What made him seem so special, so good?
Right, so picture this. You're a young shepherd just tending your flock, and bam, you're chosen by God himself to be king. I mean, that's David's origin story, right? He's not just any king. He's handpicked, like divinely appointed. And on top of that, he's a warrior who defeats Goliath, the unbeatable giant. Right. And then he's a brilliant military strategist. He unites the nation. And oh, and he's a poet whose words are still powerful thousands of years later. So it's like he's winning at life on every level.
Okay, yeah, I'm seeing the high pedestal thing. And you know what they say, the higher you climb, the further you fall. So how does this seemingly perfect king start to crack? Like, what are the early warning signs that something's not right?
Well, the lecturer points to something that might seem a little insignificant at first, at these almost bureaucratic lists in the Book of Samuel that detailed David's wives and like how many, he calls them harem reports. And while they might sound kind of dry, they're actually really important.
Hold on, too many wives. How is that a red flag in the grand scheme of things?
Because it shows a subtle shift in David's behavior. So he's breaking a specific rule for kings in Deuteronomy. It's a rule that's designed to prevent kings from being led astray by, foreign influences. The concern back then was idolatry. But the point is, David is gaining power in a way that violates the very laws he's supposed to uphold.
So it's like he's starting to think he's above the law, maybe even God's law. That's a pretty slippery slope to be on, right?
Exactly. And this is what sets the stage for his most infamous transgression, the story of Bathsheba. And it starts like many stories of downfall do with a look. David sees Bathsheba bathing, and he is instantly captivated.
Okay, but haven't we all been attracted to someone we maybe shouldn't be? I mean, is just being attracted to someone really that big of a deal?
On the surface, maybe not, but the lecturer points out something pretty fascinating, this whole seeing a woman thing. It echoes the story of Samson, another biblical figure whose downfall was triggered by his attraction to a woman. It's like foreshadowing, hinting at the danger that's coming.
So it's like a pattern, a classic trope. I mean, I'm no biblical scholar, but I've definitely seen that play out in movies and books before the hero gets distracted by a beautiful woman and boom, everything goes sideways.
Precisely. But there's another layer here that people often miss. Bathsheba isn't just any beautiful woman. The text describes her as David's physical equal, someone who could have challenged him intellectually and emotionally, not just physically.
Interesting. So maybe this wasn't just about lust. Maybe it was something more complicated. Was David bored? Or was he looking for a new conquest?
Those are great questions, and they get to the heart of what makes this story so compelling. It forces us to look beyond the surface and grapple with what drives human behavior, even the behavior of seemingly good people.
Okay, I'm hooked. So David sees Bathsheba, and then what? Does he like ask her out for coffee? I mean, this ancient Israel, so maybe a nice date by the well.
Not quite. Remember, this is a king we're talking about. He doesn't ask. He takes David sends messengers to find out about Bathsheba. Then he demands she be brought to him. He uses his power to get what he wants, no matter the consequences. And it's in this language of sending and taking that the lecturer highlights the abuse of power that's happening.
Whoa. Okay, that takes this to a whole new level now. It's not just attraction, it's coercion, using his position to manipulate the situation.
Exactly. And this is what starts a chain of events that will spiral further and further out of control. But before we get into that, let's take a second and imagine ourselves in Bathsheba's shoes. How would you feel if the most powerful person in your world, someone you couldn't possibly say no to, wanted something from you that you weren't okay with giving?
Suddenly, this ancient story feels a lot closer to home, doesn't it? It makes you think about all the ways power dynamics play out in our own lives, in our jobs, our relationships, even online.
That's the power of this story. It goes beyond time and place because it speaks to something fundamental about human nature. The temptation to abuse power, the struggle to resist it, the consequences that happen when those boundaries are crossed.
So we've got David blinded by desire, abusing his power to get what he wants. What happens next? Does Bathsheba just give in? Does anyone stand up to him?
Believe it or not, someone does stand up to David. and it's not who you might expect.
All right, so last we heard, David was making some pretty bad choices. Like, he's crossed the line, and someone needs to call him out. Are you telling me someone actually does?
Yeah, and it's not a prophet or a priest, not even one of his advisors. It's actually Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, a soldier in David's army.
Uriah, the guy whose wife David basically just took. What does he do? Like, challenge him to a duel? This is getting biblical. I can feel it.
Well, it's more subtle than a duel, but just as powerful in its own way. So David, he tries to cover up what he did by sending Uriah home from battle, hoping that he'll sleep with Bathsheba and, you know, unknowingly claim the child as his own.
Okay, that's a plan. I mean, not a good one, but I guess it could work.
But Uriah, he refuses. He says he's staying with his fellow soldiers. He won't enjoy the comforts of home while they're risking their lives.
Wait, so he's saying no to the king, like flat out refusing a direct order. That's got to be some kind of treason, right?
Well, it's definitely an act of defiance, but the lecturer argues it's also an act of incredible courage, like moral courage. Uriah is putting his loyalty to his fellow soldiers and maybe even his own sense of justice above obeying the king.
So we've got this seemingly ordinary guy, Uriah, showing more integrity and loyalty than the king who's supposed to be chosen by God. That's a pretty stark contrast. It really makes you think about who the good guys really are in this story, and maybe even in our own lives.
It definitely makes you question your assumptions about leadership and morality, and it makes David's next move even more disturbing.
Don't tell me he doesn't just let this go.
Nope, he doesn't. When his plan to cover up his sin fails, David decides to do something even more drastic. He decides on murder.
Wow, okay. Things just went from bad to worse real quick. I mean, I know this is an ancient story, but murder, that's crossing a line even for a king. How does he even do that? Does he just like yell, hop with his head?
He's a little more cunning than that. The lecture goes into the chilling details of David's plan. He writes a letter to his general Joab, telling him to put Uriah right on the front lines of the battle and then have the troops withdraw, leaving Uriah vulnerable to enemy attack.
That is cold, calculated, just awful. And the language he uses in the letter is pretty striking too, right?
The lecturer makes a really interesting point about this. The words David uses to describe how Uriah should die, They actually echo earlier passages where David is praised for killing enemies in battle. It's like he's twisting his own heroic past into something deceitful and murderous.
It's like he's using the language of good to justify doing something purely evil. And the plan itself, it's kind of sloppy, isn't it? Like, tell everyone to retreat except the one guy you want dead. Wouldn't somebody notice?
You think so, right? And that's where the lecturer asks a really interesting question. Does power, in some twisted way, actually make us stupid? Does it blind us to the flaws in our own thinking, especially when we're trying to cover up a mistake?
Yeah, that's a good point. We've all made bad decisions when we're stressed out, but most of us aren't trying to orchestrate a murder to cover up an affair. It makes you wonder if power itself just warps your judgment.
And speaking of warped judgment, let's talk about Joab. He's the one who gets David's letter and carries out the order. Huh. What's his role in all of this? Is he just following orders or something more going on?
Okay, yeah. Joab, he always seemed like kind of a wild card. I mean, he's a brilliant military strategist, but he's also ruthless and ambitious.
Exactly. And that's why his role is so complex. The lecture doesn't paint him as just a bad guy, but it does make you think about how complicit he is. He follows David's order, even though he knows it's a death sentence for Uriah, but he also tries to minimize the, you know, collateral damage as if that makes it less horrible.
It's like he wants to be the loyal general, but also not deal with the fact that what he's doing is wrong. We see this kind of thing all the time, right? The coworker who ignores bad stuff because they're ambitious, the friend who goes along with a bad idea because they don't want to cause trouble, it's uncomfortable to admit, but I think we've all been there.
Yeah, it reminds us that the story isn't just about one king's downfall. It's about the choices we all face when we have power, when we're tempted, and when we have to deal with the consequences of our actions.
So Uriah's dead. David's gotten away with it all. What happens next? Does he just go on with his life like nothing happened?
He mourns for it. Uriah marries Bathsheba, and their child is born. But like the lecturer reminds us, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord.
Like a mic drop moment, right? Even if we think we escape the consequences, there's something bigger, a higher moral authority that we can't outrun. So what happens to David? Does he face any real consequences?
Well, that's where we'll pick up in part three of this deep dive.
All right, so we're back. And last we heard, David's story was taking a pretty dark turn. He went from beloved king to, well, adulterer to murderer, all to cover up his first mistake. And then that line, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. Yikes. It's not exactly a happy ending to get away with all of this.
Well, the lecture definitely doesn't shy away from the consequences of David's actions, even though the initial cover-up seemed to work out. The repercussions are huge and honestly unavoidable.
So there's a reckoning. I gotta admit, a part of me wants to see David get what he deserves. Is that bad? I mean, he did some awful things.
It's totally natural to want justice, you know, to see bad deeds punished. But the lecturer wants us to look beyond just that, like simple revenge. David's story isn't just about punishment. It's about accountability, that complicated and often painful process of facing what happens because of our choices.
Okay, I can see that. So how does this accountability actually happen? What goes down with David?
Well, things start falling apart pretty quickly. A prophet named Nathan shows up, and he confronts David. He uses a parable to expose the sin and force David to see how serious his actions were.
A parable, like a story with a hidden meaning. I'm guessing David wasn't too thrilled about being called out like that.
Not at all, but Nathan's parable is so smart in its simplicity. It just cuts right through David's defenses and makes him see his own hypocrisy. And this is where the lecture gets into, like, the psychology of sin. You know, David isn't just facing stuff from the outside. He's dealing with his own guilt, his shame, realizing he betrayed not just the people he cared about, but his own moral compass.
So he's finally going to face the ugly truth of what he did. Does that actually change anything, though?
It's like a turning point in the whole story. David repents. He admits what he did and takes responsibility. But repentance doesn't erase the consequences, does it?
Right. Actions have consequences. So what are David's? Does he lose his throne, get banished, struck by lightning?
The consequences hit him personally, and politically. David's family is torn apart by tragedy, and fighting his kingdom deals with rebellion and instability. And the lecture points out, these events aren't just punishments from God. They're the natural outcome of David's choices. Like, his sin has a ripple effect impacting not just him, but everyone around him.
Man, that's intense. So it's not about one bad thing. It's about how long the impact of our actions lasts, how they shape not just our lives, but other people's lives. For years to come, it makes you think twice about even the small choices we make, right?
It really does. And that's one of the big takeaways from these lectures, that our choices matter, not just right now, but down the line. They make us who we are, how we deal with the world, and the legacy we leave behind.
So where does all this leave David? Is he redeemed? Is he forgiven?
Well, the lectures don't give us an easy answer.
Yeah.
David's story is complicated, messy, and in the end, very human. He makes terrible choices, but he also tries to get forgiveness, tries to fix things, and keeps ruling as king.
So no Hollywood ending where everything's wrapped up perfectly. It's more like real life with all its ups and downs. But is there any hope for David? Any hope for us when we screw up, when we don't live up to our own ideals?
That's where the lecture leaves us with its most powerful point.
Where?
You know, for all the darkness and tragedy in David's story, it's ultimately a story of hope. Not because he escapes what he did, but because he owns up to it, admits his failures, and tries to find redemption.
Yeah. It's a good reminder that even when we mess up, even when we make huge mistakes, it's not too late to turn things around, to ask for forgiveness, to try and make things right, and just live a better, more ethical life.
It's a message that's just as powerful today as it was thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. We all make mistakes. We all face temptations. We all have the potential for good and bad. But David's story shows us that even in our darkest times, there's always a little bit of hope, a chance for redemption.
That's a pretty powerful message to end on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into David's story. It's been fascinating and definitely makes you think.
It's been my pleasure. And remember, this is just one part of David's long and complex story. There's always more to uncover, more to learn, more to discover.
And that's what the deep dive is all about, exploring the hidden depths of history, culture, and what it means to be human. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time for another deep dive.